Go ahead and represent your ministry then. It's a very short bill, only 5 lines long.
Do you want to come up with me? Let's see if you can. Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Karen Minnis, representing House District 20 in East Multnomah County. I want to thank the committee for hearing this issue. This issue was brought to my attention by Mr. Lyle. He has an issue with the city of Portland being tasked to use courthouse and has not been able to come to any agreement. So we want to give him this forum to come to the legislature and so we could have the issue reviewed and if he can be helpful in some manner. So I will let him take it from there. Basically, he's going downtown to use the courthouse and practices in Troutdale, does all his conducting business in Troutdale, but he's being charged tax for using the house courthouse downtown Brooklyn. So I appreciate your taking the time to hear this issue, and I have to go chair another committee. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Minnis. Go ahead, Mr. Was it Wiles?
It's Wiles.
Okay.
Chair Skorbeck and members of the committee, my name is Richard Wiles. I've been practicing law in the state of Oregon for 17 years. I live at 2761 Northeast Corbett Hill Road in Corbett. My office and my office building is in Troutdale, downtown Troutdale. About a year ago, April of 98, I, out of the clear blue sky, received a letter from the City of Portland Bureau of Licenses. That letter, in my testimony that I distributed, there's a copy of the letter, but essentially the letter says that a recent review of records indicate that I don't have a City of Portland business license, and Portland, it's not just a license like in Troutdale, it's $35. They actually, it's a tax. I mean, it's a percentage of your net profit or your revenue. The letter stated that if I try cases or file documents at the Multnomah County Courthouse, I'm deemed to be doing business in the City of Portland. If I meet with other attorneys or take depositions within Portland, I'm doing business in Portland. And they deemed that I, because of those facts, that I would fall within their taxing authority. I was unbelieving of this letter. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. I thought it was some misguided employee that was trying to impress their boss with some extra revenue. And I wrote back and you know, I said, you cannot be serious that you're going to tax someone just solely on the basis that they're using a courthouse. I thought that really what they were saying was that I was soliciting clients or I advertised or somehow I was doing business in more traditional means in Portland. They've made it very clear that that is not the nexus that they're relying on. They have said in several pieces of correspondence and in the court case that another lawyer got involved in Multnomah County that just the mere fact that you file cases in the courthouse, which happens to be within the City of Portland, that is the nexus that they are relying on. I think it's an odious practice. It's immoral. It's unconstitutional. It's akin to a poll tax. We have a state court system. Those state courthouses, which are usually maintained by the counties, the actual courthouse, are located in the county seat of each county. In this case, the county seat of Multnomah County is in Portland, and the courthouse has historically been out there. At some point in the future, I know we're going to have a courthouse in Gresham because of all the people that live out in East County. And essentially what they are attempting to do is tax my clients who live out in East Multnomah County for the privilege of me being their representative to use the courthouse, the state courthouse, the state court system. And that's just inappropriate. Their attempts to enforce this are haphazard. I mean, I've talked to many lawyers out in East Multnomah County, and some of them have never gotten such a letter. So it seems to be just a cynical attempt to, you know, get $500 here and $500 there. One lawyer they did become very aggressive with, and that was Vern Cook. in Gresham. That case actually went to, the city of Portland sued Mr. Cook in what was then district court. That case went to trial, a year or so ago. And unfortunately it was, Mr. Cook lost on legal grounds, and that case is now on appeal to the Oregon Court of Appeals. I think my comments are well set out in the exhibit, but if you have any questions. Thank you.
Mr. Lyle, where did you practiced law in Oregon for 18 years, the last four, and Travis, where did you practice the last 14 years before that?
Primarily in Portland.
So did you have a business tax in?
Well, I worked for other people. So I worked in law firms, and presumably they...
Since they were domiciled in Portland.
Exactly.
They
exactly.
were licensed there.
Yeah. I'm not here to suggest that just because I'm a lawyer that I shouldn't pay tax. I do pay Multnomah County business income tax, which, interestingly, is administered by the city of Portland under contract with Multnomah County. So when they say they have records and so forth, I don't know what they're talking about, but they're obviously utilizing the records of Multnomah County to come up with these people that they're hitting up for these minimum license fees.
In your practice, when you were in Portland, did you have opportunity to go to other counties to do business in other counties?
I go to counties all over the state. And that's a good question, because that's the example I've given them. I would write them back and I'd say, you mean to tell me that a lawyer in Baker City who has a rancher client that happens to be sued by somebody in Multnomah County, and this lawyer comes over to Portland, is doing business in the city of Portland because he appears for his client in downtown Portland? I don't think so. I mean, that would be like Troutdale. We have a municipal court, and that would be like a lawyer in Portland or Lake Oswego coming out to try a drunk driving case or whatever they do in municipal court out there, and being told by the city of Troutdale that he or she needs to have a business license. It's the same thing.
Interesting issue. Are there any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rickman?
Do you represent any clients domiciled in Portland?
Sure.
Can you represent businesses domiciled in Portland?
Sure.
So your only contention that you're not doing business in Portland is that your office is located outside of Portland?
Primarily that. I don't do business in Portland. I mean, the fact that what I'm trying to focus on is that what they're saying is that the only reason why we're writing you these letters is because you file cases, you engage in litigation activities in the Multnomah County Courthouse, which, you know, could have been located in 1849 by the legislature in Lake Oswego, but, you know, it was put in Portland where the county seat was.
Yeah, that's Clackamas County down there.
Right, right. Gresham. There, that's fine.
Okay. Anything else?
You've argued it's unconstitutional on what basis?
The right of the citizens to have access to the state and federal courts. I mean, you know, their position wouldn't be any different if it was in the federal courthouse downtown Portland, because that's also within the political boundaries of Portland. The right of the citizens to have access to the courthouse. Also, I am an officer of the court. It's a statutory office. You know, not the Supreme Court gives me a special license because I have certain qualifications and pass tests and so forth to represent people. I mean, I actually fulfill a constitutional, I don't mean to wrap myself in the flag, but I fulfill a constitutional office in the sense that people have the right of counsel, they have the right to have jury trials, they have all these rights to use the court system, and they're attempting to levy attacks on my right simply to use a courthouse that happens to be located in their city.
Jane Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Mr. Weil, I'm looking at the city code that's cited in one of the city's letters to you, and it seems that it would cover a lot of other kinds of businesses other than law firms, businesses that are delivering goods or doing business with customers in the city. So if we were to carve out an exception that only applied to lawyers, it seems like we'd have an equity problem with other businesses that are
similarly
situated.
That's why there's my last page of my exhibit. I suggested, I have to be honest with you, it's the first time I've ever participated in a legislative process, and I'm no expert in drafting legislation, but I did suggest a revision to make that a little more specific, and that would be in Section 2. My suggestion would be to say a city or county of the state may not impose a business license tax or fee on a person engaged in the practice of law solely on the basis that the person files cases, appears in court, or otherwise participates in court litigation-related proceedings within that city or county. I really want to focus on what they're relying on as the taxable nexus, which is just simply being at the courthouse, engaging in litigation-related activities. Because you have to remember that we don't necessarily choose which courthouse that we're going to do business in. I mean, if I have a client that lives in Troutdale that needs a divorce, the state law mandates that that be filed in the county of their residence. If they're charged with a crime, that's charged in the county in which the crime committed. If there's a real estate foreclosure, that has to be in the county in which the property is located. So, you know, I could be called into many different courthouses.
Mr. Chairman.
Jay Williams.
Mr. Weil, I apologize that I missed the first part of your testimony. How was it that the city of Portland first came upon you for purposes of sending you these letters? Do you know?
I have no idea other than their letter of April 2nd. It just says a recent review of your account indicates that you do not have a city of Portland license. And you may have missed the fact that the city of Portland, by contract, administers the Multnomah County Business Income Tax Program for Multnomah County. So they collect the taxes and do all the tax returns and enforcement for Multnomah County. So when they say my account, I presume they mean my account with Multnomah County, which would include personal property tax and the business income tax, which I pay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
Being a legally impaired as Mr. Weil, I can tell you that my firm has numerous lawyers from all over the state and from outside the state of Oregon who come to my offices in downtown Portland and take depositions. In fact, I will say that my colleague, Representative Shetterly, on several occasions, has been within the confines of the city of Portland.
Oh, not true.
Is that true?
I might be costing him $500.
Never been there.
And I am confident that the city of Portland, he does not have a city of Portland business license, nor do I believe that the city of Portland has attempted to tax him for that time he was representing his client while in the conference rooms of my office defending a deposition.
Or in the courtrooms.
And frankly, I have appeared in courtrooms and at law offices in behalf of representing my clients all over the state of Oregon. And have never once believed that it required that I be subject to any other local government's tax for that temporary conducting of business.
I think that is the kind of goes to the heart of the question, and I think those are questions that we're going to want to ask the Portland people who are here. And we might want to ask Mr. Weil some more questions, but I'd like to do that now, since we do have a couple of people in the audience on another bill, no mind, is suspend this hearing briefly and address 3157, then we'll come back to this issue. Okay, suspend the public hearing on House Bill 3595. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3157. Ed, would you briefly tell us what this bill is about? And Representative Backlund, would you come forward?
Good thing, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3157 would allow an income tax subtraction for costs incurred in adopting a child, and it defines what the qualifying costs are. And it specifies that they do not include things like travel or lodging costs, medical expenses, or fees paid to surrogate parents.
Okay. Representative Beckman.
Thank you, Mr. Stolbeck. Chair Stolbeck and members of the committee, I thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify this morning. Let me say, at the beginning of this session, a constituent, Daryl Goldstrom, contacted my office asking if we could try to do something to help those, like themselves, who go through an adoption process. We're talking about a private adoption process. Since then, we have had contacts from several other adoptive parents making the same request. Written testimony is being provided by Mr. Goldstrom, who was unable to be here today. The expenses incurred by any parents going through a private adoption agency today may exceed $15,000. We're told that the average is close to $14,000 or between $14,000 and $15,000, and that may be more depending on where the parents go to adopt. Currently, the federal tax deduction is $5,000 for such adoptions. Oregon does not have anything like that, and this bill wants to bring Oregon into line, let us say, with the federal government and allow a similar $5,000 tax deduction for Oregonians who adopt. We can say that statistically, for the period of time from July 1 of 1997 through June 30 of 1998, a total of 1,755 adoption petitions were filed in Oregon. Of that total, 244 were private adoption agencies, while 427 were services to children and family adoptions, and the rest were step-parent adoptions. Now, FCF adoptions are virtually at no cost to the adopting families. Again, I would remind the committee that it may cost $15,000 for private adoptions. So I'm hoping that the committee will give serious consideration to House Bill 3157. I see the bill as a positive step to encourage couples like the Goldstroms and many others to adopt through agencies such as the Holt Agency and other private agencies. Thank you, and I would be happy to attempt to answer any questions.
Hey, thank you, Representative Backlund. Are there any questions from the committee? Don't see any. Thank you for bringing the bill to us.
Chair Stolbeck, I have to say this. When I used to teach and I gave a brilliant lecture, I would ask if there are any questions. If there were no questions, it either meant, one, I had done a really good job, or two, nobody got it. I'm hoping it's the former and not the latter. Thank you.
Back on, I think you're almost bringing too much of your life experience and teaching into this chamber.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just as long as there's not an exam or pop quiz at the end of the lecture, I think we'll be okay.
Okay. Marty Higgin, is it?
Hyen,
okay. We all figured that you were here for this bill.
I didn't think it was gas tax.
Good morning. My name is Marty Hyen. This is my son, David.
You need to get the microphone.
My name is Marty Hyen, and this is my son, David. We live at 3060 31st Avenue here in Salem. I'm a database administrator and an adoptive mom. David cost us almost $20,000, and I do know of cases where it's been $25,000, depending on where you're adopting from. There's many people out there that want to adopt, many kids that need homes, but a lot of people can't afford that. I inherited a little bit of money from my grandmother's trust, and that was the only way that we could do this. Many people mortgage their houses, get a second mortgage. Some people actually get what are called adoption loans. And to start out a new family with really being in debt, you know, it's not a really good thing. So I hope you'll pass this bill to help more people have families.
Thank you. Is this your first child? Great. Are there any questions?
How old is David?
He's 5 months.
He's a beautiful boy.
What did she say? I was looking at the baby.
What agency did you use, or was this?
We used two agencies. At first, we were going through Holt from their Vietnam program, but we were kind of concerned about the time it was going to take and the age of the child when we got the child. So we used Holt for some of the services and switched to Seattle International Adoptions, which only works with Cambodia. And so we were able to get him in a matter of months to two different agencies. And aren't total fees, including the estimate for the additional things that still need to happen, like his naturalization and readoption in Oregon, and our post-placement home study is about $19,618. and about 4,000 of that is for travel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kapoor indicated she'd be more willing to vote for the bill if she could hold the baby for a while.
Pass them around the room.
Well, we thank you both very much for coming in today. Susan Browning, did you have something to add on this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Susan Browning with the Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to point out, we think it's maybe a problem just with the wording of House Bill 3157. Our policy staff looked at the wording on line 6 and 7 and were concerned about the phrase, to the extent included in federal taxable income, and suggested that phrase should be probably deleted from the bill because an adoption fee is more like a doctor bill in expense, and it would not be included in your federal taxable income, actually. So the way it's worded right now may not get to the intent of what the sponsors want to have done on this bill. So they suggested the deletion of that phrase, and then having legislative counsel put in the standard phrase about something about no deduction shall be allowed for amounts already deducted in calculating federal taxable income, preventing any kind of double dipping type action.
Okay.
That's simply a technical correction that they pointed out to make sure that this achieved the intent of what the sponsors had in mind. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Ed, in your revenue impact, you say it's uncertain, but you asked us to consider that if 1,000 families qualified, and the average adoption expenses were $1,000, it's based on the testimony this morning that average is probably a little low, so the estimate would be a little low, wouldn't you think?
I was totally in the dark, Chair. But given that we do have some information now, I can make another run at this.
Okay. You might also consider, as Susan Browning just said, making sure that it's not double crediting, and also putting a dollar cap on it, just similar to the federal amount. And for the calculation of revenue impact. Any more?
Just a quick question about the math on that revenue impact. That looks like a 20% impact, and I'm a little confused why that would be the case as opposed to 9%.
Do you have an answer for that?
Oh, these numbers are very rough, Representative Murphy. They're rough all the way around, so I rounded it up.
I think we'll get a little more specificity on that as we move forward. Is anyone else here to speak on House Bill 3157? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3157 and reopen public hearing on House Bill 3595.
Chair Strobeck, I forgot to introduce Greg Reamer. He's the general counsel of the Oregon State Bar, and he... the bar did participate, I believe, in the litigation that Mr. Cook was involved in, so he had information for you.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Good morning. The bar did appear as an intervener in the lawsuit that has been filed by the City of Portland against Mr. Cook, who is a lawyer from Gresham. That case is now on appeal to the Court of Appeals, and I'm really not going to get into that particular piece of litigation. But the underlying kind of policy issue is an important one. And in Mr. Wilde's situation and Mr. Cook's situation, if you have a lawyer outside of a city and you come into the city for, let's say, even one case, are you subject or should you be subject to a licensing fee of a minimum of $100, as is the situation in Portland? They even have a presumptive kind of tax that could, I think, bump it up even to higher than that, to $500. The question is, as a policy matter, at what point is this connection or activity in the city something that should be taxed? Representative Rosenbaum had mentioned that this could apply to lots of other folks, and I totally agree with that. This needs to be looked at from a broad standpoint, that it's not just lawyers. It could be any other professional or anyone else doing business. And that gets into a definitional question of what is doing business. But some case law suggests that it's the business or occupation, and it's not just an incidental act in conjunction with that business or occupation that is the taxable event. Mr. Representative Williams had mentioned there are, I'm sure, hundreds of lawyers from outside Portland, if not outside the state of Oregon, who are in Portland every day doing some aspect of the practice of law. And the question becomes, are all of those people in violation of the law? Are all of those people required to have a business license? Dozens of lawyers come to Salem every day, or at least every week, arguing cases before the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court. Are all of them subject to the City of Salem business license tax? Anyone else who comes to Salem on an incidental basis concerning some business that is located outside the city, are they subject to the tax? The city business license, as I've read the ordinance in Portland, doesn't have a de minimis exception. And so I would think, and speaking on behalf of the bar, we would think that some further study of this issue needs to be undertaken to determine if there is some threshold or some reasonable distinction between certain incidental activities and a more ongoing, consistent type of appearance that would justify the imposition of a city or a county business license tax. So that's the principal kind of policy level issue, but it's an important one, and it certainly affects hundreds and hundreds of lawyers, if not lots of other professionals and business people across the state.
You haven't run across this in any other city, Mr. Reimer?
You know, I've not seen this this type of application of this business license tax by other cities, though you would think could certainly easily be replicated. There are lots of cases across the country that have dealt with the application of business license ordinances to lawyers and others. I don't think there's any question that lawyers are subject to the business license tax. I guess what we're arguing, or at least presenting as an issue, is where do you draw the line if you have your full-time office for the practice of law in Troutdale, and you do come in just incidentally to Portland to conduct business for people who reside in Troutdale, is it fair that you should be subject to this minimum city license tax? Now, I'm sure you want to hear from the city and all of the other taxing authorities as to what their impression is as to the fairness equation, but I think that, we believe, needs to be looked at.
And what is your response as far as the Bar Association is concerned to Representative Merkley's question about Mr. Wild's office may be located in Troutdale, but he represents Portland-based clients?
Well, I guess it would go to the question of what is de minimis. At what point in time should there be a license requirement? When is it triggered? Is it an ongoing systematic type of appearance? The point that is made for the courthouses that are located in particular cities, lawyers do have to go to the courthouse. It's the county courthouse or it's the federal courthouse. And if you start saying that the city is entitled to impose a license a fee for those types of appearances, you do kind of wonder, is that right? He already pays the county business license tax. And then you add the city license tax, and then it becomes a question of at what point is fairness, is that kind of, does it become unfair, not only to Mr. Weil and other lawyers that are similarly situated, but also to their clients?
Let me ask another question. If you don't mind. Does Troutdale have a city business license?
Yes. I mean, but it's just based on number of employees. It has nothing to do with revenue. So I pay, I think, $35 a year to have a license.
But even if you were just one person in your office, if you were incorporated and doing, based in Troutdale doing business, would you be required to get a Troutdale license?
Yes, I think if your business is located in, I don't think there's any question that they pay the business license tax there.
Representative Shatterman?
Well, thanks. That raises an interesting question to me about the location of clients. I have clients, or have had clients, who live in Portland. So, I mean, you pick up an estate and the personal representative may be a resident of Portland or some transitory representation on a transaction where, you know, for a year I might have a client in Portland, and I've been up to see clients in Portland. Sorry to intrude in your Sure, I was getting a little upset.
Yeah. But, you know, I guess that does raise the question, when on earth does this tax apply? And especially when you have these periodic or episodic relationships with clients. And I'm sure it's not just lawyers. I don't want to complicate the bill, but I'll bet, you know, my insurance agents in my town have clients who they represent who have lived in Dallas and moved to Portland, and they still maintain a business relationship with. Is that subject to tax by the city of Portland?
Well, I've discussed this a little bit with the city, and while I think they would say, well, if it's just one particular incident, they wouldn't tax. But again, I don't recall seeing any kind of an exemption or de minimis exception. And so I use the example, you have an attorney coming from Medford, flying into Portland International Airport, making a call from a payphone at the airport to a client in Medford. Are you doing business in Portland? There needs to be some examination of the threshold upon which you trigger this requirement to pay a business license tax. This sounds, you know, you have like a five-line bill. This is quite a complex question. It applies, and I guess I would like to reiterate, I don't consider this just to be applicable to lawyers, and I wouldn't like to see it fashioned in that way. This affects everyone. And so that needs, I would suggest, needs to be studied to determine what is fair and reasonable for cities and other taxing authorities to impose a local business license tax.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the city now.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that Mr. Reamer is disciplinary counsel for the Oregon State Bar Association.
Actually not. We have another person that does that, but
oh, okay.
I've certainly done that in the past.
But he does that. And so he's kind of a, you know, lawyers kind of hate to see Mr. Reamer come around, and I've frankly been waiting all session to have him on the witness stand, and the first time he gets up here, we actually agree on something. It's extremely disappointing for him. Thank you.
Hey, Jim Wadsworth, Terry Williams, and Linda Main for them.
Good morning, Chair Strobeck, members of the committee. I'm Jim Wadsworth. I'm the director of the city's Bureau of Licenses. With me on my left, my immediate left, is Terry Williams, our audit manager, who is our tax specialist and also a certified public accountant. And on the far left is Linda Ming, who is with our city attorney's office. We'd like to share our concerns with you on this particular bill. The city of Portland business license law went into effect really when the city was chartered in 1860 and is in its current form since 1975. It's a privilege tax that's assessed on all businesses doing business in Portland. Businesses are required to license with the city when maintaining a regular and routine presence within the city limits. Presence occurs when a business owns real, personal, or intangible property located within the city limits, or when its employees provide product or perform services for the business or for the business's clients and generate business income within the city limits. Businesses that have activity both within the city and outside the city of Portland are allowed to apportion or divide that business income among the various locations where business products or services are provided. In this way, a business can apportion income to Portland that represents only the business products and services that are performed within the city. A business that rents real property or personal property apportions income based on where that property is located and so forth. House Bill 3595 would allow a specific single profession, in this case the practice of law, to be exempt from this tax and possibly from many other taxes if the principal practice is located outside the geographic boundary of the city or county that's imposing the tax. The bill doesn't really define what principal practice means. And an example of that is a large legal firm with offices in five different cities, one of which may be Portland, exempted from the tax because its principal practice, which is not defined in the bill, is not within the geographic boundary of Portland. Since 80% of the firm's offices and personnel are outside of Portland, some might interpret that answer to be yes. Therefore, the city of Portland and Multnomah County would be prohibited from imposing taxes on any of the firm's activities, no matter how significant. 3595 could also be interpreted to allow exemptions from other taxes, and in one case is from the transient lodging tax that Portland imposes when they're in Portland and the practice of law. But this one may have some other far-reaching effects. In the case of the transient lodging tax, the hotel and motel industry could be subjected to additional increased administrative burden to try to account for and report the tax by jurisdiction. And since cities and counties throughout the states impose a tax of this type and impose many other taxes similarly among cities and counties, it could generate a substantial tax revenue shortfall, and that affects local general fund expenditures. In the case of the transient lodging tax, including tourism, which it's supposed to support. Again, thank you for the opportunity to express our concerns, and we have Terry Williams here, who's our tax specialist, and can answer your questions.
Okay, Shadow,
thank you. Interesting point about the hotel and transit lodging tax. I like this bill. Now I love it.
he could take clients to sporting events.
You bet.
Pay this ticket charge.
Yeah. No, actually, I have a serious question. In the second paragraph of your testimony, you said the second sentence, businesses are required to license the city when maintaining a regular and routine presence. Is that language in the city code? I mean, regular and routine, is that in the city code?
It's not specifically in city code.
I was going to say, because the letter that was attached to Mr. Wild's testimony sure doesn't address that regular and routine aspect, and I think that seems to be the heart of the problem.
Yes.
Your testimony describes the tax differently than how it's being enforced.
Representative, sir, we know it's not being... Our testimony is describing, yes, how it is being enforced. The code doesn't specifically address it because at the time when that code was written, there was not...
Would you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Terry Williams. I'm the audit manager for the Bureau of Licenses, City of Portland. Sorry. What has happened since the inception of that code is there is a U.S. Supreme Court case. You may have heard of it, Small Chewing Gum Company, Wrigley. And through that, while they deal with products, the U.S. Supreme Court did establish a de minimis standard. They established it in such a saying, yes, there is one, but they didn't exactly draw the line. We have adopted an administrative rule on de minimis, which is not in the code. The code authorizes us to adopt administrative rules. We have one dealing with de minimis activity for tangible personal property, which is products. In our administration, though it is not written, we extend that same de minimis standard to services as well. The court has not come out with any, there aren't any court cases that discuss a de minimis level of services, although we try to use that standard across the board.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
Can you explain to me the process by which Mr. Wild alleged violation of your taxing code came to the attention of the City of Portland?
Yes, I can, Representative Williams. And it's not just necessarily Mr. Wild. There are two things that we've looked at. One, we always look at between the city and the county records as who's paying who and is there a reason. Since Portland is 95% of Multnomah County, is there a reason why somebody paying Multnomah County isn't paying Portland or somebody paying Portland isn't also paying Multnomah County? That's something we first do. When we find something that we believe might indicate that one or the other isn't paying, then we go and look for other evidence to suggest that there's activity in the jurisdiction. In the case of attorneys, and not just Mr. Weil, we went to the county courthouse and looked for filings, and not just one filing a year or an occasional or an incidental or haphazard. We looked for repeated. Then we sent out letters to and others that says it looks like you're doing something, and we were requesting either that they get that or tell us what their level of activity was so we could determine that it was de minimis. In some of those letters that were sent out, there was an attorney that was out in East County, and I'm not sure exactly Gresham or Fairview, who said they practice family law. Family law court now allows all of the filings to be faxed in or through the mail. She always met with her clients in her office, didn't even have to appear in the courthouse. And we said, thank you very much, when we went away. When it sounded like there was a higher level of regular routine, proceedings every month, depositions coming in all the time, things like that, then we would pursue further.
Mr. Chairman? Hey, William. I'm interested, I guess, in this issue in particular, being a litigator. There's really only one place that I get to go to argue motions in Multnomah County, and that's the Multnomah County Courthouse. Mr. Weil really has no other choice, frankly, but when the judge that his case has been assigned to happens to be in a courtroom in the Multnomah County Courthouse, to drive into the courthouse, into the jurisdiction of the city, to make that appearance. I guess I struggle with kind of him being forced to go to a location that happens to be within the city of Portland. How do you deem that fair, I guess?
Representative Williams, we don't only look at the court filings. We are looking to see, do they do other things that are outside, taking depositions at various locations, not necessarily only in the courthouse. And if we get an answer that talks one way or the other, that's part of the issue, trying to find out what the level of activity is to see if it warrants a license or not. As an example of the only place to, Portland's got a very large international airport, the only place the airplanes can land, but in the same way as those airline companies not doing business there. They're selling the tickets and recruiting those passengers. I mean, in using an example that it's the only place to go, there are many, many examples of that. A doctor with a hospital that's got the surgical staff. There are lots of examples.
Mr. Chairman, might I follow up?
Yeah, let's do one more question, and I meant to have Ms. Ming give her testimony before.
Okay. I guess, again, I'll use just my own personal experience. Oftentimes, Mr. Weil's clients don't always have the option to determine who's going to sue them. And if I'm suing one of his clients on behalf of one of my clients, and it comes time to take a deposition, of my client, practices that he comes to my office to depose my client.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something he frankly has an option unless he simply refuses, and I have to now start driving outside of the jurisdiction of Portland to take depositions for lawyers who don't want to come with inside the jurisdiction in order to conduct business. I guess this is a very strange situation for me to in this particular instance, and I recognize the international airport flavor, but somehow I think the one place you get to go to receive justice, which is kind of a fundamental right as opposed to flying, which I don't think is a county courthouse, and I find this a very strange juxtaposition. I'm done, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Yeah. What's your date?
Go ahead, Ms. Ming.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Linda Ming, and I'm Chief Deputy City Attorney for the City of Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you on this bill this morning. I have two basic points. One is that the bill is both overbroad and oddly narrow, and as been pointed out, only having it apply to lawyers, I think that would invite many other professions and occupations to come in and say we should be entitled to the same exemption from taxation. In that sense, it's narrow. And on the other hand, it is very broad in that what is principal practice? If you did it on a percentage, you could say someone could earn 49% of their income in the city of Portland and not be required to pay a business license tax in the city. So what is doing business is defined by the city, and as you've heard, there are constitutional protections For what is de minimis, there is a limitation. And as you also heard from counsel for the bar and Mr. Weil, there is a case on appeal that the city won in the trial court, making constitutional arguments against the city's business license tax. The city did prevail in the trial court. Presumably, if the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court believes it's an unconstitutional matter, they will rule in that regard. I wanted to point out that the city's business license tax has been upheld since 1903, and the apportioning business license tax has been upheld also. It has been upheld as to lawyers in particular. Lawyers do engage in a business, and I understand that it's related, being a lawyer, it's related to justice, but lawyers do engage in a business, and the court has upheld the imposition of a business license tax on attorneys. The case in 1955 that held up taxing a portion of a business had to do with a bakery, the city of St. Helens, where someone was delivering baked goods and said they shouldn't have to pay a tax to the city of St. Helens, and the court upheld taxing a portion of a business. This business license tax has been an important part of the revenue base for the city of Portland for a very long period of time. This would be a considerable encroachment on the city's ability to raise revenue, as we have done since the beginning of this century and longer. So we ask you to reject this bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, I'll try and be brief. I know we want to get on with something more interesting.
This is interesting.
I guess, Linda, you don't like principal practice, but why is that any worse to the standard than regular and routine? You know, that's offered in Mr. Wadsworth's testimony. And to me, that's no less clear or harder to get a handle on than regular and routine, which apparently is the standard that you work under now.
I think principal practice could be defined, but I think if you look at defining it, if it was going to accord, I would think principal means more than half. So that's why I'm saying if you take that standard, then someone could earn 49%. Of their income in the city of Portland, and you would say, well, they're not doing business in the city of Portland, they can't be taxed.
Mr. Chu?
Yeah.
Again, but I'm not sure that, I guess on the other hand side, though, I'm not sure that regular and routine really is a de minimis test. I mean, if I've got I think we broaden this out beyond lawyers, because I think it should be, but going back to the insurance salesman, if I've got a client who started a small business in Dallas, I'm an insurance salesman now, and business got moved, and they relocated. That's right. They relocated, and now they have their office in Portland, but they want to maintain their relationship with me. They've moved to Portland, and now I have one account. It may be a fairly large account. Does that make me subject to the Portland tax if I maintain that? Or do you have to get in and audit the rest of my business accounts to determine whether that's whether that's de minimis or not? But it's regular. It may be one account, but it's regular. It's a regular account. I maintain frequent contact with that client, servicing their insurance needs, but they may be my only client in Portland. How do you determine whether I'm subject to the business tax in that case?
Yes, can I answer that? Representative Shutterly. For a service, and that would be for an attorney, accountant, and agent like that. It's based on where that individual is performing the services in which he's being, which he's producing income for. So if you, in your office in St. Helens, say, and you have a Portland client, if that client is always coming to you, you're doing nothing outside of your office for that client, then you would not be being taxed by Portland because you're not actually doing business inside of Portland.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
This gets out in the paper. I think we'll see a lot fewer lawyers, insurance salesmen, accountants, farmers, and other people traveling to Portland to see their business associates.
Exactly.
Mr. Chair, may I make one more comment?
Sure.
There's been discussion here of fairness, but one of the foundations of this ability here is that you do have minimum contacts with the city of Portland. That means that these people come into the city and use the services of the city of Portland. So it's not just that the city's getting something, it's that the people who come into the city use, you know, the city's fire and police and streets and the other services of the city. And so there is a connection there between coming to the city and engaging in business in the city and paying the tax.
Again, if I can just say us downstaters and out-of-towners will be troubling you less, I think, with those services. When word gets out generally about this risk of tax liability for going into Portland to see a client.
Can we broaden this just for a second? You referenced this bread delivery case. Let's take somebody who has a warehouse, Safeway or whoever, just outside the city, or a soft drink company or something, that makes deliveries inside the city regularly to grocery stores. Do they, if they're based in Clackamas or somewhere, do they have to get a City of Portland business license to deliver products to grocery stores in the city?
Yes, they do. Delivery of products into Portland with the company's employees or trucks would constitute nexus and therefore subject them to licensing.
A farmer that sells the wheat?
Yeah. Well, is that in every case, regardless of if something is headquartered in Chicago and they deliver to Portland?
If something is headquartered in Chicago, it could very easily be that they're using a freight forwarder and not their own company, so they don't have any physical presence in Portland. So in that case, they would not, unless it was their own company trucks that drove from Chicago with your employees and then offloaded the deliveries in Portland.
And do you get into the apportionment business with how much of their total business? Do you go audit their books and say you delivered, you know, $1 billion worth of Coca-Cola and, you know, a third of that came to Portland? Do you get into that kind of a deal?
Yes, we do.
Is it $500 for them, too?
Maybe, may not be. It depends on their net income and what their apportionment is. Any business would have a minimum fee, which is now at $100.
Are there any other questions? I think this is really interesting, and it's not just because of the lawyer aspect of it, but it's ironic that in the era that we're trying to get rid of tariffs, establish free trade zones, and do all this thing, this pops up as an enormous barrier. You know, we can ship goods to Canada and Mexico and South America without tariffs, but you can't do business in Portland without tariffs. And, we have heard several bills this session that have made a real strong point that we want to send a message that Oregon is receptive to business and is business friendly, and that what the business brings is a thriving economy, and we all benefit from that. And your testimony is that, well, if somebody comes into Portland, they're essentially using up Portland rather than contributing to Portland. And I think that's an interesting perspective, as well as we're told all the time that if we delete a tax credit, we're sending a chilling message and we're being hostile to economic interests. And it seems to me that this is kind of the same message that this kind of enforcement, you know, this active processing that you're doing, it sends that same kind of message. And I agree with Representative Shetterly that it's probably going to have the effect of people thinking twice before they want to do business in the city of Portland.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to comment on that fact. And I think that your last point that this has been going on since 19-whatever, I think if there would have been negative effects of it, we probably would have seen it by now. And I don't know that the city has been lacking in people doing business.
The apportionment is not really unlike if you go to another state and earn income in another state. You could be taxed on that income that you earn from your activities in another state. And it's the kinds of apportionment, that idea of apportioning income is not that unusual.
Well, but if you go to other states, you have property, payroll, and income, I believe are the three tests, not just whether you actually conduct any commerce at all in another state. Am I not?
I think we've been told that.
Yeah, I think we've been told that before.
For instance, if you're just selling in Idaho or something.
If you don't have a presence there, if you don't have property there, if you don't have employees there, you're not taxed if you're just selling products to or going over and visiting somebody in Idaho.
Well, although I'm just saying that the test may not be identical, but the idea of apportioning your income from where it's earned is not, it's not that unusual of an idea.
Just to comment that this is not an income tax.
Right. Well, in a way it is.
Yeah. I mean, I get it, it works that way, yeah.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kapoor.
I'd be interested, are there other cities in the state that...
Exactly what I was going to say.
That we shouldn't be going to.
Stay at home, Wayne. I was just going to ask the league to maybe, next time this bill pops up, to bring us some information to see if every city that has a business tax, a business city business tax, is aggressively pursuing the same kind of enforcement and licensing, and if so, how do other cities deal with their neighboring cities as far as taxing each other?
Mr. Chairman, I'll be recommending that we look more strongly at doing as many possible court filings by electronic means and fax means, and perhaps even some local cities around the Portland metropolitan area may want to consider lowering their business income or business tax license fees and create somewhat of a tax haven for maybe we can have just one little city full of law firms.
I think also if I understand the testimony right, if you use a third party, you know, a shipper, if you're Chicago based in the example, you could do your filings and then give it to somebody who's a delivery service that's based in Portland and have them do it.
Just a while, I may want to start using the transfer people more often to get us papers to the courthouse.
Sure, I got my rep names on the line and certainly need to listen to the land use laws too before they do move to that thing.
Oh.
There's probably something there we'll restrict you to.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close public hearing on House Bill 3595. Thank you for bringing that to our attention, and we'll be revisiting this issue. We're changing out of transportation. By the way, we're not going to be hearing House Bill 2473 today, if anybody's here for that particular bill. That was put on the schedule before we knew that Representative Witt was going to be gone. He wants to be here since it's his bill. And that will be up again on Monday. So at this point, I will open public hearing House Bill 2082. And we have a lot of data to go over from Dick Yates, but I'd first like to ask Doug Riggs from the City of Redmond. Dennis, that's more.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Doug Riggs. I work for Pacwest Communications, actually a constituent of Representative Williams in Tigard. But I grew up in Redmond, Oregon, so I'm a little bit familiar with some of the problems that the cities face. So that's what I'd like to discuss here today, and I'll be brief. I know you've heard from other witnesses. As you may know, Redmond has been the state's second fastest growing city over the past decade. When we moved there in 1971, I think the population was approximately 2,100 people. A relatively small town, fairly sleepy, timber-based economy. Today, there are 14,000 people living in the city. And if you drive around the outskirts of the city outside the urban growth boundary, an awful lot of that has been developed as well. So there are several thousand more people outside the city. The population of the city has more than doubled in the past decade. But the problems, transportation-wise, that the city faces, which are not uncommon in this state, are not simply the result of population in the city. In large part, it's the result of the growing regional population. Bend and Prineville have both grown significantly. And then also, Highway 97 and Highway 126 have become major transportation corridors, especially Highway 97, as truck transportation between California and eastern Washington has increased significantly. And one of your colleagues, Representative Crummell, actually has a bill that the Transportation Committee has passed out to look into creating a larger interstate corridor that he calls Interstate 82 that runs down mainly Highway 97. In fact, as far as volume, truck traffic through downtown is now the third highest volume in the state next to portions of I-5 and portions of Interstate 84. The north-south traffic through Redmond, which is through 5th Street one way and 6th Street the other way, now carries over 10 million tons of freight per year and exceeds 4,300 vehicles per year. I passed out a photograph that I'd asked you to take a look at. I think this is illustrative. If you take a look, this is 6th Street, which runs south through downtown. 5th Street is over here on this side. And this is your typical afternoon traffic, about 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock. This is not rush hour traffic. This is almost every single day. On the weekends, it can be during golf season or it can be during ski season. And if you look at this picture and follow it all the way up, you can see it extends all the way through downtown, bumper to bumper to every single traffic light. You go several blocks beyond the scope of this picture, and this is almost daily.
Mr. Rigg?
Yeah.
Have you thought about requiring each one of these people to get a business license?
It's an excellent question, but we need $5.6 million a day if we tax every one of the 4,300 vehicles $1 million a day, or you know, we'd probably be right there. So, good thought. I'll take that back to the city. Anyways, you can see we've got a problem. The city has long recognized that this has been a problem, and my dad was involved in city government for a number of years. I remember planning for a truck bypass and a long-term bypass actually started back in the mid-1980s. So this is something the city of Redmond looked at Bend, and if you've been through Bend, you've certainly seen the transportation problems that the city of Bend faces. And they've worked very carefully and very diligently to try to come up with an alternative. They've come up with such an alternative to get the large trucks out of downtown, which is one of the most significant problems. The city and the community have stepped up to the plate and put $12 million in financing together for this project. The federal government has provided through T21 approximately $4 million. But that unfortunately leaves this particular project about $5 to $6 million short of what it's going to take to complete it. And as you well know, ODOT will not start a project until they have full financing. So this is certainly something we need to do. What I am here today just briefly to suggest is that we want to express our strongest support for a transportation package. We also discussed extensively with a number of the members of this committee as well as the Transportation Committee, Representative Lehman's proposal, which is a revenue bond proposal to use up to 2% or 2 cents per gallon to bond for transportation projects. And that is one of the things that went into extensive discussion during the Transportation Committee, which is citizens of this state are willing to spend additional money on roads if they see a return on that investment. And providing a significant amount of money up front for specific projects like this, like the 217 I-5 problem that we have in our neck of the woods, I think will give citizens of the state the clarity they need to justify spending the additional money. So on behalf of the City of Redmond, the entire Central Oregon community, we want to thank you for your diligence in having these hearings. We will do whatever we can to support the measure as it moves out of this committee to the floor and the Senate. And with that, I conclude my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. Dick, would you explain what we have before us now?
Mr. Chair, Dick Hayes, Legislative Revenue. When the cities and counties testified the other day, they were of the opinion that the Dash 11 amendments were before you, but I had not received them, and you had not been given them at that point, so I've simply copied them and presented them to you today. Basically, if you look at those, what they're doing is changing, on line 3 of the amendments there, they're changing the percentages of current revenues. In other words, the bill, House Bill 2082, has two revenue components. I'll call them old revenue and new revenue, I guess, so that the new revenue is the amount raised by the tax increase. They changed the distribution of the old revenue. It currently goes 24% to the counties and about 16% to the cities, and then the balance, 60%, is with the state. So this would change that so that the counties get 30%, the cities 20%, and then the balance, 50%, would remain with the state. Then in line 14, they're putting in a new fund. If you were here last session, that was part of the transportation bill at that time, to put about $3 million a year into Eastern Oregon counties to replace federal forest, lost federal forest fees. And at the top of page 2, current law does provide for special allotments for both cities and counties. The amounts are there. They're bracketed out, and blanks are put in. I presume the I don't remember from the testimony, but I presume the purpose is to increase personnel. Same on page 3. And then beginning on page 3 of line 27, section 19, for the fastest growing counties in the state, they're essentially requiring the state to charge a $10 additional registration fee per vehicle on behalf of those people, on behalf of those counties. The last thing then, the Eastern Oregon Federal Forest Safety Net account that's set up for $3 million a year is sunset in year 2007. Okay, what I've done with this packet of information is try to get to you some of the information that's coming out of the Highway Cost Allocation Study, and I apologize for another acronym, but you see at the top of the first page there, HCAS, and that we're talking about the study that was commissioned by DOS to look at the relationship between cost and revenues paid by different vehicle classes and vehicle weights, and to do essentially a cost responsibility study. Coming out of that then, at the top of that first page, are new recommended registration fees for vehicles less than 26,000 pounds. In the first column there, current fee is what is now in law. Then the bold numbers are the recommended fees out of the study. And then the changes there, you see some fairly large increases in the middle with reductions at both ends. So it's kind of a reorganization of those to bring those weight groups into line with the revenues that they're paying or with the costs that they're imposing. In the middle of the page then are flat fees. Again, these recommendations now are not for this bill, but they're for current law. Okay, that's what the model has looked at. So they do not include any adjustments you might want to make for the 4 cent increase in the fuel tax. So again, for the flat fees, you see the current amount, the recommended amount, and the change. The big significant change there is for the wood chip haulers, almost a doubling. More than a doubling of the tax rate. The way that the model generates these tax rates is to compute the amount of tax that those vehicles, they have essentially DMT, estimated DMT for those vehicles. They go through and compute what those vehicles would pay if they were under the weight mile tax, and then set the flat fee so that on average for all vehicles they raise the same amount of money.
Okay. Dick, this, let me get back up just a step. There's the split, the truck portion and the automobile portion. This is only dealing with the truck portion, and the split and the highway impact is, that's part of 2082, right? You said this particular calculation is not, and so I assume this is what we're talking about in relation to truck tax.
I think what would be before you now, if we didn't have a proposed tax increase, is the question of how do you want to adjust the registration fee and the weight mile taxes for heavy vehicles to bring them into alignment with the new cost responsibility that comes out of the study. So now you've got two problems. You've got to do that. You've got the opportunity, let's say. You don't have to do that, but in the past, cost responsibility has been the basis by which we've adjusted these rates. So you have two problems. You have one to bring it into line with current law, but also then to make any adjustments you might want to make to recognize the increase in the tax rate that's in this.
Okay. But you just said that these are readjusted from time to time. But the adjustment, is it between how much, is it the cost responsibility theory that we're talking about here as far as how much impact trucks have on the road versus how much impact cars have on the road, and then subdividing the truck impact into these different categories?
Correct. Okay. Let me ask you to just, for the moment, jump. We'll discuss that a little more later.
Okay. Then could you also, even now or when it's appropriate, discuss this particular 1999 study in relation to its predecessor studies and how it's different, and I've been led to believe this is a new model or a new calculation, and if that isn't, what's different about this from other studies?
Yeah, I think we have to take some time to do that, Mr. Chair, and at this point, as I said, we're beginning to get some information on the model. I would like to wait until we have a final draft so we can kind of go through and look at the model, and that, you know, is maybe a week or so down the road.
Okay, so these numbers are not based on the new model?
Yes, they are.
They are. Okay.
I've sort of been in a position at a number of us of trying to determine the priorities for the contractor, and I've had priorities of trying to get adjustments for this bill, House Bill 2082, to a higher priority than getting out the final report. And, you know, that's the decision I've made.
Okay.
I hope that's consistent with your interest. But these are the numbers that come out. The model is finished, but the final report is not done. And you know, these fees came out yesterday morning. So it's getting out now. Moving on then, the bottom part of the table is a change. The contractor is recommending essentially a change from current law. If you look in the bill on page 2, line 20, it specifies that the road use assessment fee for single-trip non-divisible loads is 5 2/10 cents per diesel per equivalent single-axle mile. And the contractor is saying that you'll better represent the cost responsibility if you use a table, essentially, which is what he's suggesting then is the table at the bottom of the page here, which runs from 98,000. We're dealing with a very heavy vehicle here with the road use assessment fee. It only applies to vehicles over 98,000 pounds. So he set out a table here from 98 to 150,000 pounds and for axles 5 through 9. And these then would not be a charge per easel, but a charge per mile. Now, this table is not big enough, actually, for what the motor carrier division needs when they actually tell a carrier what you've got a big load, a big bunch of bridge beams or something that's going down the road, and they have to know what the tax rate is going to be. For a 20-axle vehicle pushing 400,000 pounds down the road. And so what the Department of Transportation does then is to essentially take this 5.2% and produce a table like this, except that it's real big. And so my conception at this point of an amendment would be to put this table in statute because it's of reasonable size, and then let the department by rule sort of expand it. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
I think you get the general concept.
Page 2, then, of in the material is just the current tax rate in Oregon law. You have two tables, table A, which does not differentiate between axles. So you just have one column of numbers there, which run from, they're expressed in mils, 41.5 mils, or $41 per 1,000 miles traveled, or 4.15 cents per mile, however you want to read it. For comparison purposes, let's look at the 78 to 80,000 pound range. That's where you've got, you know, the dominant class in terms of where the vehicles are. Our current rate is $136 essentially per 1,000 miles traveled. And then above 80,000 pounds, you do have axle differentials. Coming out of the study then in the following page would be the rates if you wanted to maintain that table A and table B concept. So the axle differentials only apply over 80,000 pounds.
Dick, which one is A and which one is B?
Oh, I see.
If you look, probably that's clean. If you look at page 2 of the bill,
okay,
at what's bracketed out, you see a mileage tax rate table A.
Right.
And that applies up to 80,000 pounds, and there's only a single rate. So the top part of my table here, up to 80,000 pounds is table A.
Okay.
And the bottom part of my table is table B. Okay, a couple things to notice there is you move from lower weights. Under current law, at the lowest rate, it's $41 per thousand. That jumps up to $62. You're talking about a fairly large increase. However, in that dominant class, you're dropping down from $136.50 to $124. Okay, so there are some significant changes in the weight mile tax rate. I asked the contractor then to extend the current law rates here, extend the actual differentials down to 20,000. And on the next page then, you get what they would recommend for weight mile tax rates under current law if you were to extend the actual differentials down to 26,000. And again, you can see the rates in there. Again, it's 78,000 pounds. You do, now you would have a higher rate, 169.5, if you're only using a four axle vehicle, about the same at five, and then tailing off quite a bit with the axle incentive rate being lower.
Okay, between page 3 and page 4, these both are titled 1999 HCAS weight mile tax rate for current law. So why would the two axle on page 3 at 62.5 be different than it is on page 4 where it appears to be 71 for two axle?
You have an additional degree of freedom, essentially, in terms of achieving cost responsibility because you can allow the rate to vary by axle. What you're doing is, on the first page, you've got one column of numbers, and on the second page, you're spreading those out to 2, 3, 4, and 5 axle vehicles, actually up to 6 and 7 axle vehicles before you get to the end of that previous table A. And on average, in that first group, weighting by VMT, in other words, $71 for the VMT for two axles, 51 times the DMT for five. Waiting that way, you'll come back to the 62.5 cents. So on average, those vehicles are paying 62.5 cents. But you get closer to cost responsibility because when you put those weights on a two-axle truck, you have much higher axle loads, you're doing more damage on the road. So this makes you pay more if you're hauling that same load with a two-axle than if you put another axle under the vehicle or you get a larger vehicle.
Mr. Chair.
Tim Merkley.
Essentially, between the two tables, you're sustaining revenue neutrality.
Yes.
So since you're lowering the price for multiple axles, you have to increase the price for two axles.
Right. Yeah. The next page then just shows you the differentials. You can see that basically what's coming out of the study, if you look in the first two columns is you see that those vehicles with small numbers of axles, 2 and 3, were basically not paying their cost responsibility. So that the weight mile taxes are increased in those low axle groups to get more revenue out of those groups. And the opposite is true if you move down to the bottom part of the table. On the right-hand columns, they're mostly negative. So that the very heaviest vehicles were actually paying more, with those at least with a large number of axles on them, than their cost responsibility share. And that's kind of a realignment in the weight mile taxes to reflect the results of this study and how those results differed from the previous study.
Okay. And that, for the committee, I think is kind of the essence of the issue involved here is whether we want to make that change, you know, as a policy matter.
Yeah, I think all of these issues are policy matters, whether you want to adopt the new registration fees for the vehicles below 26,000 pounds, the new flat fees, whether you want to change the road use assessment, and then what we're going to do with the weight mile tax.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Okay,
are we going to be hearing testimony on that?
today, or? Nobody signed up today because we don't have, actually, we don't have 3344 in our possession yet, and that's what most of this is relating to, is the truck tax issue. Okay, now I sort of move into trying to get estimates based on a study for this bill, 2082 with the 4-cent increase in fuel tax and the $10 increase in registration fees. Page 6, then, is one exhibit which will be in the final report and shows the cost responsibility share, initial sort of share, without any adjustments for tax subsidies. You have a lot of vehicles, government-owned vehicles, that are not paying the full fee. They have lower registration fees. Some school buses, for example, may be not paying fuel taxes. Eventually, we want to adjust the cost responsibility shares to reflect some distribution of those subsidies back among the full fee-paying vehicles. So this analysis is before that adjustment. And what you find in the bottom right-hand corner is the overall cost responsibility share for heavy vehicles of 38.8%. Okay? And then you find two columns over at the bottom of that column, the cost responsibility share for just the local money, the money that's distributed from the highway fund back to cities and counties. So it's a lower share. And what bothers me then in terms of getting to an estimate for this bill is the distribution changes in the bill. So the money doesn't go out in the same proportion that it does currently, but more of it is directed to the lower, to the cities and counties where the cost responsibility share for heavy vehicles is lower. So what I want to try and do is adjust that to reflect the bill. Now, Exhibit 2, let's just skip that. I've already talked about that. That just blows up this local column. The next page then is got, again, too many numbers, really, but I put it in so you can go back and refer to it. That's most of the stuff I do. The thing here is you've got that 2,000 weight classes, and it's not necessarily to tell the story. So if you just turn over to the next page, we can collapse those so that we have fewer numbers to look at.
Is that page 9?
That would be page 9 now. And again, what we've done here is to take out the tax subsidy and then reallocate that back among the full fee-paying vehicles. And the decision of the study review team, essentially, a policy decision that they made, was the way in which this allocation was to be made. There's a lot of ways you could do it. The contractor essentially is saying that he thinks the most correct, really, you know, economic theory or cost accounting theory doesn't have a lot to suggest how this should be done. My feeling, I guess, just to put it in perspective, is it probably ought to be a general fund expenditure. I mean, when you people grant an exemption for a certain type of vehicle from taxes, why should other highway users have to pay that?
Same reason we grant tax credits.
So that's kind of the question that's involved in deciding how to reallocate those subsidies. And what this does is to reallocate them back by DMT. And that means that essentially 93% are going to basic vehicles and 7% to heavy vehicles. So it takes the subsidies and hits the broadest audience, essentially, which is all of the basic vehicles. So this becomes the key number is in the middle there in terms of cost responsibility, heavy vehicle share, 36.1%. All right, now what's in, what came out of the last study was 37.7%. Okay, so this is a drop in the heavy vehicle cost responsibility share. And that's what's coming out of the model, the results of their study. And that's what I want to adjust now for this bill, to recognize the change in the distribution more toward local governments where that's lower. Okay.
Anybody understand this?
No. But I'm for it. Oh, no, I'm not.
Dick?
I hate to make you explain this again, but this tax subsidy, what you're calling a subsidy, is essentially the non-collection of taxes for certain classes, like school buses and things. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, and you're saying Table 7A, which is a summarized version of Table 7, is allocating that lost revenue among all vehicles in proportion to their number of miles traveled. Is that correct?
With one modification, it's not back to all vehicles, but to all full fee-paying vehicles.
Okay. All right, that's fair. And it's not based on, it's not differentiated by weight or by axles, it's just on miles.
Yes.
And you think that's a more fair way to spread that subsidy? That was a choice that you made.
That's a choice that the study review team made.
Study review team, okay.
Let's leave it there.
Okay.
Some examples in the bill, for example, of what's taken out here. On page 7, you have the registration fees for standard commercial vehicles. And then you have, on the next page, registration fees for charitable vehicles. You're allowing them to pay lower registration fees, so they're not a full-paying fee. And you've made a decision that they should be charged less. Now, somebody's got to pay for that, in a sense, because they cause the same damage to the highways as these commercial vehicles. And that's the question we're addressing, is who pays for that?
But aren't most charitable vehicles much lighter than 80,000 pounds?
Then they would be in the lower weight class. But, you know, for an equivalent vehicle, a 12,000-pound vehicle, which is a charitable vehicle, versus a 12,000-pound, which is a commercial vehicle, they ought to be doing the same damage to the road.
Yes.
They're not nice if you're
charitable vehicle. Yes. They don't have any impact at all on the
road. I just seem a little nicer as they roll over.
Okay.
And that's, if one other alternative that was considered by the study review team would be to allocate these costs back in proportion to the cost responsibility of the full fee-paying vehicles. So just forget about them. Figure out what the net costs were. In other words, the cost of the exempt or partially exempt vehicles less whatever the partially exempt vehicles pay. And then take that and distribute it over the cost responsibility of those full-paying vehicles. And that would have raised this 36.1 up to 37.5.
We're only talking about the Table 7, 7A. We're only talking about this subsidy portion.
Yeah. Let me take a second here to talk about what's going on with those registration fee changes. You have, for these groups, their cost, the ratio of revenue to cost. Now, that should be 1 if they're paying their full share. All right? If they're overpaying, it ought to be larger than 1, and if they're underpaying, it ought to be less than 1.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the variance in there, and the change in those registration fees is intended to bring those closer to 1. Okay, you can't do much. You can't differentiate by weight group in the fuel tax. But you can, by weight group, differentiate with the registration fees, and in that way, you can try to get the cost responsibility shares for these different weight groups closer to 1. And that's what the model is trying to do, what the recommended rates are trying to do. Well, the next table, let's just say at this point, and any of you want to come in and talk about it, we will. But what I'm trying to do is to get a cost responsibility share for heavy vehicles, given the difference in the distribution. We see 36.1 is the correct rate, given the current distribution, 60, 24, 16. Now, the new money in the bill goes out
only 32.5% to the state, 4% to the counties, and then whatever's left, 23.5% to the city.
Mm-hmm.
So the numbers at the bottom are what I come up with. So this 36.1 is dropped because you're allocating more money to the local areas where the cost responsibility share is lower. And so it drops to 35.7. You can go through the method of that calculation for anybody who...
But that's only for the 4 cents in this particular case?
That would change if you want to raise that more to...
In the current bill.
That's what's in the current,
bill, 4 cents through that distribution.
Right. In the current bill, you've got a $10 increase in the automobile registration fee and a 4 cent increase in both the diesel fuel and gasoline taxes. And that new money goes out differently.
Right.
Again, the next page has got too many numbers on it because it's annual. But if you want to look and see what's happening for each year, you can look back. If we turn to page 12, the same table is on a biennial basis. It's got half as many numbers to look at. Across the top, we have current law, which means before the gas tax increase and registration fee increases, these are the revenues that would be generated from both basic at the top, from basic vehicles, and these come essentially from, are generated out of the forecast, which ODOT does. Then what we have is, for heavy vehicles, the assumption that was made in forecasting these was that the cost responsibility share would remain as it is currently. It's not the cost responsibility share, it's the tax rate. Essentially, we're dealing with current law tax rates, so no change in state mile taxes, no change in the registration fees, the flat fees, or anything else. These are the revenues that would be generated from heavy vehicles. And it's interesting that they're growing over time. And that's because the VMT among heavy vehicles is growing more rapidly than it is for basic vehicles. That's what's happening with current law. Now, for House Bill 2082, I key on the basic vehicle revenues here. And basically, what we have is the current law plus the effect of the 4 cent increase in gas tax and the $10 increase in registration fees. So you get the total amount that's going to be collected from basic vehicles there, $958 million in the 1901 biennium. This takes effect January 1 of 2000. So you get about three quarters of a year in that first biennium, and then when you have a full effect, you get about an 18% increase. Now, for purposes of determining how much should be paid by the heavy vehicles, I key to those cost responsibility shares. So if the basic vehicles are paying basically $1 billion, they're $958, then the cost responsibility share should be 36.5 coming out of that analysis, and I compute the total for heavy vehicles, what they should pay if that's their cost responsibility share. And I simply subtract off what we get in the road use assessment fee, registration fees, and fuel taxes. The residual band is the weight mile tax. But I need weight mile taxes that will collect that amount of revenue. The bottom part shows you the impact, what you get out of the bill. In the 9901 biennium, it was $124 million, a 9.1% increase. And then the first biennium is fully in effect, you get $187 million, a 13.1% increase. So what you have, if you look at that middle column for 2001-2003, you've got an 18% increase in basic vehicle payments, about a 5% increase in payments by heavy vehicles, and an average overall increase of 13.1%. OK? chain. The reason it's low on the heavy vehicles is because this study comes up with a lower heavy vehicle share. And so if current law were to continue, that heavy vehicle share would increase to 38.5. If you look at the bottom in the first section of the current law, the heavy vehicle share is up to 38.5. That needs to be dropped down to 35.7. And so you collect less money from this. Even though you've got a tax increase, the net effect of the tax increase less the adjustment for the reduced cost responsibility share or heavy vehicle share results in a 5% increase.
Okay. You guys all paying attention down there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Okay. Next table is...
stay after committee for...
the next table, then, is what happens to your weight mile tax rate. And what I did is to take the rates that are in ours, or the contractor said this was a reasonable way to do it. Take the rates that he proposed for the current law and increase those by a factor of 1.06. And what that does is to generate essentially on the next page, or on the previous page, page 12, the weight mile tax for the increase in heavy vehicle fees needs to be $26 million in the 2001-2003. So I need a 6% increase in those rates to get that $26 million. So these are the rates. Now, again, keying in on certain figures, that 78,000 to 80,000 pound class for five axles is now $132. So that's below where it currently is at $136. But obviously above what it would be without the fuel tax rate increase. You remember it dropped 11 cents if you were to accept the contractor's recommendations and extend the axles down to 26,000. That class would have dropped 11 cents. But now if you turn the next page, what it does is it comes back up 7.5 cents because of the tax increase in this bill. So the net effect is it's still $4 per 1,000 miles below the current rate.
Again, this is all based on 2082 as currently written.
That's correct.
It came from transportation, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Up to the next two sheets, just look at distribution a little bit. Who gets the money? So you take those same dollars that were generated from the previous tables. Across the top, you've got the total amount for distribution there. So you've got, let's take 2001, or 2001, you've got about $700 million for distribution. Under the current law, and the state would get about $417 million. And what that is 60% of the amount less $750, $750,000, which goes to the special city and special county allotment. Comes out of the state distribution and goes to those special allotments. The county gets 24.38%, so it would get about $169 million, and that's reduced by $500,000. So you got $500,000 coming out of the state, $500,000 coming out of the county, and that's the county special allotment. And as you move down into cities, in general, they get 15.57%. They would get $108 million. That's reduced by $250,000 plus $250,000 from the state gives them a special allotment of $500,000. New money, total amount from the bill is about $96 million. 32% of that going to the state. That's right. $31 million, 44% to the county, and 23.5% to the city. Now that's the bill as it is. So if you look at the total then distributed, you get the numbers just adding up those two. And then at the bottom you have the percentage increase in the total distributions. So you see
that the new money essentially increases for the state. And again, staying with that 2001 column, the total amount available for distribution increases by 13.8%. The amount going to the state increases by only 7.5%. Counties have a 25% increase, in cities a 21%. So it changes the distribution from the bottom end. Under current law, the state is getting 60%. The average of new and old money would drop that to 56.6. The counties were getting 24.38. That would increase to 26.8. And the cities were getting 15.57. That would increase to 16.6. The next page I did, since I had the Dash 11 amendments, I went through to show you the effect of those. And basically it's the same. If we look at the bottom, what happens in that 2000-2001 year is the state actually loses money relative to current law. They would lose 38.7 million. And relative to House Bill 2082A, the Dash 11 amendments would reduce the state share by about 70 million.
And what if we make some changes in 2082?
Then I work late.
Okay, so seriously, basically all these calculations and charts and everything that you have done relate to 2082, even though the primary subject of that is gas tax, but it's the relative impact on the truck taxes, weight mile, cost allocation, et cetera, based on the actions that we take on the gas tax that are also causing all this to have to happen.
Yes. You do in the bill, you know, it addresses the weight mile tax by repealing the existing tax with the A and B tables and then inserting a table, which is one table, and replaces those two tables. But it allows for actual differentials down to 26,000, but it's all blank. So my presumption is you need the numbers to fill in there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm trying to generate.
Okay.
Is the numbers that should go in there based on the new highway cost allocation study.
Okay.
I guess I'd back off. You don't like to use words like should, so I would say the numbers that would be recommended by the new highway cost allocation study.
Right. Understood. Okay. Any questions for Dick? And the remaining members?
Great. Very comprehensive and in-depth. It was great to have this data brought forward, and I appreciate his hard work.
Sometimes it would be nice if we could just deal with just the gas tax. Just do that, and then we have this other complication.
And a fair one, too.
Okay. Well, I think you have a schedule. Thank you, Dick. Mm-hmm. We have a schedule for tomorrow. We have a long list of tap-in bills for tomorrow. And we're scheduled for 8:15. We'll be picking this issue up again. We also have the work session on our tax credit bills, incorporating all the decisions that we made the other day. So that's what we'll be doing tomorrow. Then we have 10:15 floor. So we're going to adjourn.